everyone. Holy shit. Have you read The Overstory? Because if you haven't, I want you to stop what you're doing right now and read that goddamn book. I had four or five friends recommend this thing to me. It's a book about trees. Not exactly a great hook book about trees, but I finally opened it up, and it is one of the most sweepingly gorgeous books I've ever read. The Overstory. If you have not picked it up, read it now. It's by Richard Powers, and it's a book about trees. You will see trees differently and observe nature through a different lens after reading this book. Highly recommend it. The Overstory 2024. Get it now. It's 2024, everyone. How we doing? For those of you who have been listening for a long time, for those of you who are newer listeners, welcome to the show. My name is Kyle. Lots of conversations, lots of rambles. I use this podcast as a way to fumble my way through life into more interesting situations. When I was very young, someone wise once told me, so it doesn't matter what you do in life, so long as you are continuing to move outward, and whatever vehicle you can find to move outward in your life, you should hold on to that, whether that is the vehicle of moving outward in thought, that could be writing for you, vehicle of moving outward physically, could be a van for you, or it could be as simple as sending more emails to people who you like and want to be like, because if there is a truth that I have found, it's that it's the truth of compounding interest. And I bet you didn't think I was going to say that, did you? Because if you just do something enough for long enough, slowly your body and your brain changes in a really profound and powerful way. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to just be around those people that you want to be like. People try and complicate the whole like optimization movement. How to become the best that you can be, achieve your goals. It's so simple. Just surround yourself with people that you want to be like. Spend more time with them. Make yourself useful to them. And slowly you will pick up different tricks and tips. That's what I think, at least. That's a big way that I try and look at my life and make decisions in my life. Do I want to be around this person more? Do I feel like they have an interesting perspective that can lead me into a better way of thinking? And it's just such a big difference, right, between thinking shitty thoughts and being around people that are negative and gossipy and small, and people who talk about ideas and possibilities. And another, I'm just a quote machine today. I feel like I'm a fucking Hallmark card. All we're doing is arguing reality through language. That's all we're doing at any time. And when we can be around cool people, they change our perception of reality, and everything else is just a bonus. Before we get this podcast going, I want to let you all know about my newsletter that I send once a weekend. It's just a question that I ask and some writing, some rambling. If you'd like to hear more of my rambles in email form, just once a week, I send it, and you can click the link below this podcast to get that newsletter. Speaking of dudes who are constantly searching, seeking new perspectives, learning. My guest today is Ben Moon. Ben is a guy who I have known for a while now. We talk about our first meeting at the beginning of this show. I won't spoil it. But we've just not really crossed paths in human form very often. He is a extremely talented photographer as well as writer. I'm going to read his bio here because I could never do it justice myself. Ben Moon is an adventurer, lifestyle, and portrait photographer whose vibrant images have graced the pages of Patagonia catalogs for the past 18 years. In recent years, he's shifted his focus to filmmaking. In 2015, he founded his production company, Moonhouse, as a platform for collaboration with friends and creatives to bring a wide range of thought-provoking, impactful, and cinematically beautiful stories to life on screen. As a director, Ben's unique ability to connect with his subjects paired with the talent and experience for visual visual storytelling allow him to bring a high level of emotional and physical depth to his films. Surviving colorectal cancer in his 20s inspired Ben to develop a deeper connection to others and the natural world, and gradually shifted his artistic focus from capturing the pursuit of adventure to telling nuanced human stories that have inspired and impacted millions worldwide. Most notably, he told his own story about his journey with colorectal cancer and his special relationship with his dog, Denali, in the viral short film, Denali. Ben currently resides on the Oregon coast, where, in addition to his film and photo work, he is building a house and just published a personal memoir called Denali, A Man, a Dog, and the Friendship of a Lifetime. It was published on Penguin Books and is about his journey with cancer and his life with Denali. Please welcome to the podcast, Ben Moon.
Kyle Cameron here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
It's not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up. Thumbs up.
Yeah.
All right. Boom. Ben Moon in the house, in the flesh. So good to see you.
Yeah.
I do feel like I know you better than I probably do, because I've had a lot of conversations with you on the phone. I've seen you once at Burning Man with a big mason jar of urine in your hand, I believe.
It was a 5-gallon bucket.
A 5-gallon bucket of urine in your hand, and you're like, "Hey, are you Kyle Tierman?" I'm like, "You're Ben." Right on, brother.
And you were in a hurry to get to the Port-a-John's, like, and it was one of those, like, I didn't really want to linger with gallons of urine, and you didn't really linger with that.
Yeah. People don't talk about the side effects of psychedelic mushrooms being having to take massive dumps immediately. People talk about bad trips, but, you know, you know, I have a funny Burning Man psychedelic story. So my brother Toby went to Burning Man. He took me to Burning Man very young. I think I went for my first time when I was like 16.
Oh, wow.
And he's been back every year since. He's been like 12 times. And one year, he gets super high on acid, and he goes into one of the porta-potties, and he looks into the corner, and there's a camera filming him with a little red blinking button. And he's so high that he can't tell if it's real, because everything else is hallucinatory as well. So he gets out and he goes back to the art car and he goes, "I swear there's a freaking camera in that porta potty right there." And his friend's like, "That's fucked up. We like, what? That's crazy." So he tries to take him back to the porta potty and it's gone. So everyone doesn't believe him, right? 2 days later, he goes to another set of porta potties and he sees another camera in the porta potty. He's like, "I told you guys." They end up taking it down, and it was a prank that people had just set up
with these little red LED
little lights. Red LED things to make people paranoid while they were already on drugs.
Well, yeah. All that to say, yeah, we have never had a discussion in person other than passing. And I'm
very happy to do it. Yeah. Very happy to do it.
So, I was just down coming down for my friend Zoe McDougall from the North Shore. She's having a little film premiere for a film she made. And we met quite a few years ago through, I think it was like a Cliff Bar Athlete Summit or something. And she walked up to me and she's like, I'm a huge fan and like, I want to be your friend. And like, cause she'd seen Denali or something and was a huge dog lover. And we've just become buds ever since. So, So I want to come down and support her. And
that's super cool.
She's on the mainland. So, you know, yeah.
How many times have you been to Burning Man?
Only once. That was my one and only. So yeah, I was always one of those people that was like, well, I can't rip on it until I go once to see what it was. And I had a bunch of friends who were veterans and just went and hung out with them. Some people I'd done some filmmaking with, and yeah, it was cool. It was a very pleasant weather year too. So it was nice to kind of reminds me of New York City. You know, it's like you could do anything you really want to do in a very short amount of time, but it's like all what you want to find. But it also, I also found it to be like incredibly, it's like you have the extreme of emotions. It's like you have, like in the city, you're like, it's so overwhelming that you feel really lonely at times. You're like, whoa, I don't really want to go out into the fray. I want to find some like one-on-one connection. And there's so much happening that sometimes it's hard just to like, leave the like nest and go into the,
it's
overwhelming.
I think it's overwhelming. I think that probably 2 out of 3 people have a breakdown at one point at Burning Man. And the rest of the time could be the best time ever, but I think it's the heat and the stimulation and the cultural overwhelm. I think that there's really something to one of my favorite things about that place is how thoroughly it rips you out of your own culture. And how they encourage that from the very beginning of when you get in there and if you're a virgin, you need to roll around in the dust, ring a bell and scream as loud as you can, I'm not a virgin anymore. And that so quickly gets you out of your comfort zone, which is a good thing, but I think it can also, just that amount of newness and novelty day after day after day can sort of unhook your previous identity in a way that stabilizes people in sometimes a very healthy way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, and it is, there's a lot of magic to it. I think, I mean, I wouldn't mind going back. It's just, it's one of those things that it is what you make of it, you know, and whatever you kind of just got to let go. It's kind of like going into any like plant medicine or psychedelic experience. If you're like have preconceived notions, it's probably not going to go down the way you expect. But if you just go in with an open mind and, you know, have some guardrails that you'd kind of like to stick to, like, you know, whether or not those stay up or not, it's a question, but it's, having the intention just with life and with anything is just like, that's where it's going to go, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but being around good people too, and being open to meet other people too. And that's just life, you know, it's like we get in our little comfort zones and, you know, our routines. And I feel like places like that just kind of break you out of it. And obviously that's what psychedelics do too. That just help you get out of the ruts. And like, I remember Cole's interview, that was a really fun analogy. I'd never heard that before. That just kind of smooth out the ruts and
smooth out the ruts. Yeah. Do you consciously work to meet new people? You know, so many people, and like, what did you ever kind of make that decision that I'm just going to continue to meet new people, spread your kind of network, like spend, because it does take effort, and I think that it's a skill that a lot of people don't have. And as you get older, it's, I think, even harder to meet people because you don't have them out around the schoolyard. But I was taking a look at your Instagram and like, man, you have a very diverse range of people that you know and have made contact with. Do you think it's just a symptom of being a photographer or something else?
I mean, you know, photography and filmmaking have definitely introduced me to a lot of people. And I feel really fortunate with that, but also, you know, the Patagonia, you know, I first published an image with Patagonia, I think in 01 or 02, you know, and so that's been, you know, that ever expanding circle. And I was always kind of the utility shooter for them. It was like climbing and lifestyle and, you know, some surf and some, you know, just in gen, just kind of, I was always, I guess I'm always open to meeting new people and trying new things if it feels right, and it's just following the intuition. So it's like more of an energetic thing. If someone, I feel like I align with someone, then, and you know, we can share space really well, then I'm excited to meet them. And then usually, you know, if someone's like that and, you know, we're really in alignment with who you are, like usually the people that they associate with also
are tend cool.
to be that, you know? And so yeah. like it kind of, it was interesting, like living, you know, moving out to the, I live in Pacific City, on the Oregon coast, and, you know, moving out to somewhere where a lot of people think is fairly remote. It's like, that is actually, I've never had so many people come as guests and stay, and just like randomly coming from here or like all over the world practically. And it's like, there's just always, when you live or in activity or with a group of people or community that others can align with, I feel like you just, all people are always in that flow, you know? And obviously, you know, the darkest parts of winter, you know, around the holidays, but even then there's not really a downtime anymore. Like people are still coming through, and you know, it's like the Oregon coast is raw and beautiful. And, but I thought I was going to feel isolated out there, and I feel more connected than I ever have, you know? And yeah, it's 2 hours from Portland. But I can, you know, I could fly down here, you know, to LA or this zone. The Ventura, Ohio, Santa Barbara zone has always felt like home away from home for me. Just
you got a lot of friends there.
Working with Patagonia for so long. And, it's always, I don't know. And I used to stay down here in Santa Monica, was my buddy Brett Denon. He used to have a house here that was a bunch of musicians, and it was just kind of a hub. And I like how easy it is to get in and out of this part of LA, you know. Like deep LA kind of has always been a little claustrophobic for me, but I, you know, this, we're close enough to the ocean where I feel at home.
Oh, it's, yeah, it's great. I mean, I was very afraid when I moved from Santa Cruz down here, but I've been pleasantly surprised by the amount of nature and adventure and like-minded people too, who are into that same kind of shit that I am. So how long have you lived in Oregon?
25 years.
Whoa.
Officially now. We just passed a year. So yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I moved out January 99. So.
And where were you before then?
I grew up in Michigan.
In Michigan.
So, yeah.
Okay.
So I was born in New Orleans, because my parents were, kind of hippies and passing through. And, but then my dad's from Michigan. And so we moved out to Western Michigan, and always lived near Lake Michigan, which felt, you know, this, there was always a sunset over the body of water, which felt like an ocean in there. And so I've always felt more comfortable, with the sun setting over the water instead of rising. You know, it's just like the East Coast always feels a little weird to me, but the West Coast always felt comforting. And so, I moved out, yeah, to just kind of define climbing and the mountains. And, you know, I was really into climbing in college, and wanted to go have an adventure. So, and then I kept trying to move down. I almost moved to like Bishop area for a while, the Eastern Sierra. And then, you know, obviously the Ventura zone. I always really enjoyed all the, you know, surf and people there. But something always kept drawing me back to Oregon. And I've lived in Portland a few times, and Bend, and in the Gorge. And but the coast, I've been out there for 8 years now, full time. So.
You dig it. Yeah. And then do you do, from Oregon, would you just jam down to Yosemite a lot to go climbing? What was your, or is there good climbing right around where you were living in Oregon?
Yes, Smith Rock was near there, near Bend. And so that was my, that was kind of my little home away from home. It was, it's one of the really famous sport climbing place, but it's kind of the birthplace of American sport climbing, I think. But it's also just, it's a beautiful, it's a, it's, volcanic, it's welded tough, like these, kind of like compressed mud rising out of this river valley with basalt canyons beyond that. And it just, it is a very, there's, you know, eagles nesting there and, you know, mountain lions. And it's a very, majestic place. The light and the way the light would play through there would mean a lot to me. So I would, that's kind of my hub. But then I would go up and down the, you know, from Joshua Tree up to, you know, or to Red Rocks to Bishop to Yosemite wasn't on my general routine, mostly because living in a van and having a dog was always a pain there. And so I just kind of went to places where it was a little easier to kind of tuck away. And, you know, everybody would go kind of just up to Squamish and British Columbia. And Sonny Trotter was one of, who's also Patagonia ambassadors, one of my kind of the athletes I worked with the most. And he grew up in Canada, actually not far from where I was in Michigan, but like he lived in Squamish and we traveled a ton together. And, I think I met when he was like 18, he's getting his first sponsors and I was reading a how to photograph rock climbing book. So it was like one of those things where kind of, you know, you always kind of, a lot of photographers will kind of have one athlete that they shoot a lot with initially. And, Sonny was that, and he and I are still really good friends, and his wife and Lydia. Oregon just kind of felt like home to me. I don't know what it is. I think it's just, I like the seasons. The coast is a lot more temperate. It doesn't get as cold or hot. And then also just I've got giant sand dunes near me, and you know, just feels a lot like this my favorite beach in Michigan. Mm. There's something about, it's a gathering place. It's been that way, you know, and the Stuck of people, it was their home, and that is
the Stuck of people.
Yeah, all the tribes that lived there were usually named for the river. Mm. So it used to be called the Nistugga, I think, but. So that river comes out in that kind of cove area there that's between Cascade Head and Cape Lookout. There's a little cape called Cape Kiwanda. And then every salmon river kind of had its own little band, you know, like smaller group. And so there was, you know, a lot of small, and those, from what I've learned and read, it was like a lot of smaller group. It was like a few hundred. It wasn't like a massive, just because of the terrain was more rugged and stuff. So
I mean, a lot of those tribes too were very small. Like about Dunbar's number, the human brain can physically hold about 125 people in its mind of like, oh, I know that person really well. Beyond that, like you can kind of remember some names, that kind of thing. But the many tribes were, the bands were 125 people. Huh. So there's an evolutionary adaptation to how many people we can hold in our minds, and often how those bands travel together was about 125 people. I'm becoming so fascinated with this kind of stuff, man. I was fun fact, I was just on a trip kind of up the North Coast with a couple buddies of mine from Montana, and one of them has Native American heritage, and so he's studied a lot about this kind of stuff, and he was telling me about the Crow tribe, and there's a book called Chief Plenty Coup. Have you heard of this? Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty cool like concept that I've thought of many times since he told me. So in the Crow tribe, the way that young warriors would have rites of passage were it was called a coup. So if you were to count coup, it meant that like you had achieved your rite of passage, and they were constantly tested. So a young warrior would be forced to, okay, you got to swim across the Yellowstone River in December in the dead of night and steal some fish from this other tribe and then swim back and survive. And if you did that, you had counted coup. So Chief Plenty Coup, the story of him is that he had he went up to the crazy mountain range in Montana outside of Bozeman to have his vision. And have you ever been to the Crazies or heard of the Crazies?
I've been to that area, but not to the Crazies.
So the Crazies are it's a rad place to go backpacking, and it's a place where a lot of these tribes would have their, and specifically the Crow tribe would have their vision quests. So Chief Plenty Coup went to the Crazies, and they would starve themselves to have visions. So he's starving himself up there, and the vision's not coming. So he decides to cut off his finger to have the vision. Logical next step. Cuts his vision off, cuts his finger off, and has a vision that the white man was undefeatable, and that they as a tribe would need to basically homie up with the white people as much as possible in the decades to come, Otherwise, their tribe would be destroyed. And that was the tactic that they took through the late 1800s when many of these tribes were being put on reservations and assimilated. And the Crow tribe was one of the few tribes that were able to have a reservation be on their native land. They weren't removed and put into another location, you know, when that assimilation happened during the late 1800s. Fascinating story.
Yeah, I've been trying to learn more, and I don't know if there's any surviving members other than Nisqually, but we see signs, and you know, occasionally like Arrowhead shards will roll up, and I can't imagine how magical that place was when just the salmon running thick and before the rivers changed with all the, you know, farmland, and cause it's not far from all the cattle country where Tillamook is and everything. And, but then before things were overfished, and, it's still such a lush place for foraging and, could go get 5 pounds of chanterelles across the street. You know, it's a pretty wild, and spearfishing there is really, spectacular. And, but I was trying to learn more, and it sounded like the tribes there did initially try to, like, you know, because it was just a survival thing. Everybody would just kind of, from what I've read, I would like to obviously dig deeper. I've been trying to, but initially there was a lot of sharing of resources and teaming up. And then when those decrees came down from the government, and eventually they were all brought to this place in the Salmon River, which I think they thought was going to be an awesome thing, but then they realized they'd been duped, and a lot of those, now there's a bigger the Grand Ronde and Siletz, and there's a bigger organization. But I think that, like, with one thing I've been really interested in is the Alaka, I think it's called the Alaka Alliance, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, it means sea otter. They're trying to bring back the sea otters that were basically hunted to extinction in Oregon for their pelts. And because of all, you know, there's the urchins are destroying the kelp habitat. And so there's a lot of that. And I know that the tribes have a lot of say and are on the board for that. And that nonprofit is like, I'm really hoping it's successful. Cause I've seen how, you know, how much the kelp has shrunk. And, you know, I used to just be able to find, you know, you'd find a kelp forest and just find, you know, be able to dive that for like a half hour and get your limit and be out of there. And now it's like harder and harder to find those. Right. And the urchin population isn't just exploded.
Right. So for people who don't know, the urchins will climb onto the kelp and essentially eat away the kelp. Otters are these apex predators that take down a lot of urchins. And are there no otters off the coast of Oregon?
No, we have river otters, but no, there are no surviving sea otters. They tried to reintroduce them in southern Oregon, I think in Brookings, but it just didn't quite work. So now they're working to make that happen. And now they're recognizing that kelp, I just saw this announced, I don't know all the details, but I think that some research indicates that salmon use kelp as habitat while they're in the ocean. And so that could be massive for this restoration project, both to help with kelp restoration and with bringing sea otters back. Because if salmon, you know, salmon's just one of those indicator species that like everybody can get behind. And I feel like if that is publicized, then people can really get behind the fact that, well, if we could bring back the salmon populations by bringing back the kelps, then that'll be huge.
Yeah.
And then also the sea stars died off, like, what is it, 10 years ago or 10 years ago, there was a big die off and they don't really know why. I think it was some virus or something. And those were the only things that were really eating the urchins. And so they just had no competition whatsoever.
I used to go dive, red abalone up north of the Golden Gate Bridge when I was younger. It was super fun. You know, you go up and it was very strict guidelines, but you could do it legally. And during that time, it was very kind of fragile whether or not they would let you go in the next year. But the abalone numbers had decreased so much because largely the urchins, they were competitive in eating the kelp and gaining territory on the kelp. So, I mean, I know that one of the arguments for why people didn't want to bring back the otters is because otters eat abalone, but because the urchin population has exploded so much, the abalone are fucked too.
Yeah.
So it just creates this, you know, it's a weird thing.
Yeah, you wipe out an apex predator, it's always going to mess up the ecosystem. Right. So, and, you know, no matter if it's on land or in the sea. So that, yeah, it's, and, you know, that there's not, like, there's been some talk of like, oh, we could, you know, harvest them for food, but then there's only certain types and they have to grow to a certain size to actually, you know, be uni. And I have eaten it, you know, right, just diving, you just tap the bottom out and eat it right there. And I'm not a big fan of it when it's been shipped and sitting, but like when it's fresh, you know, same with like scallops, you know,
right,
slice it open right in the ocean. It's amazing.
So you've mentioned twice so far light already on during this conversation, light across Michigan lakes and light climbing. And this is something that I'd never really considered, but I'm fascinated by how you think about climbing photography. And I would imagine that, because my only, like, I know a bit about surf photography. I can't do it, but I know how those people do it, and you know how a good water photographer will line up with a wave that's coming in, how there's this real art between knowing where that wave is going to be, where the surfer is going to be, and where you need to be to all line up and get that shot. What's a comparable comparison as a climbing photographer? Because I would imagine like you need a certain amount of skill just to be able to get up there with these athletes. But what are some of the other things that you are thinking about when you have an athlete like Sonny, who you've worked with so much on a climbing shoot? You know, for people who are maybe were interested in photography but have no concept of climbing photography.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of factors at play. One is, you know, you've got to get the ropes up there and everything, so you've got to make sure you're either pre-rigged or, you know, have someone climb the climb ahead of time or find a nearby climb to rig. But, and then, you know, another thing is your shadow. So you can't, you know, be just hanging right where you're casting a shadow over the climber. But you also have to like, Jumar or like ascend a set of rope at this, you know, at a pace. So you have to time, it's all about rhythm and finding, you know, shooting and then being ahead of them during a move or whatever. And so there's a lot of like pre-thought. I tended to be more someone who was more like in the moment and like to find the moments in between rather than have a preconceived notion of a move. But you know, there's, I remember being up on El Cap with Sonny and, he was finishing up this climb called the Prophet. It's on, further right than where the Dawn Wall was, where Tommy did his big climb. And Tommy was in the valley at the time and he kind of, I'd actually never gone up the east ledges in the dark, and so I had to like, I got there the night before, got the beta how to get up there, and it's just like kind of crazy scramble and, you know, figuring out where to be. And because Sonny and Will were on the last two pitches of the climb, and so they were like, you know, 1700-1800 feet in the air, and so nobody else was on the entire face of El Cap, which is just wild, you know, just so quiet, and it's November and it's just a really rare thing. And I step across this little trickle of a waterfall, which I kind of was the landmark, and I see this single rope tied around a tree with a single carabiner, a locking carabiner. And I was like, that's got to be Sonny, because he always had the sketchiest anchors. I was like, just this rope dropping into the abyss. So I wrapped down that rope, just hoping that's where they were, rappelled down. But the first attempt was in the, you know, bright sunshine. And so like, if, you know, if it wasn't November, it would be way too hot to climb at that level. It was like a 514 something, which is, you know, pretty extreme difficulty, especially on granite.
Is that because the heat makes it?
The friction goes away. Your friction shoes goes away. Get so hot. Your feet, the rubber gets soft. It's like, it'd be like if your wax was just melting on your board and you couldn't, in your, you know.
Great comparison.
Couldn't get any grip. And then your fingertips, you know, they get sweaty and then the friction's just terrible and then your skin peels. And so it's all about climbing is like finding, you got to find the time when the light is right, but also
It's not too hot.
It's not too hot. And so it's kind of got to be the time of year. In the winter, the light's usually way better anyway. It's more crisp and the colors are better. But the first attempt, he tried it and missed, but it was kind of like broad daylight, you know? But then he had one last go in him before he had to go home. And he'd been there for like 2 weeks working on this climb. And I remember being up there and the light just turned that like absolute alpenglow. Gold, and then the whole El Capitan was like lit up, and it was just so special. And he had this one client, one move he had to latch, but he was like run out like 20 feet from his last piece. So if he fell, he's gonna fall like 40, 50 feet. And I'm up there tensioned off to the side, and like had sticky rubber approach shoes on, and my feet were tensioned. And I saw it was like as he was going for that one move that was like right next to me, like my feet started to like. Nori.
That's a good story. Keep going. This is a great story.
That's Nori, everybody. But my feet were just starting to slip, and so I was just like, I knew if my feet blew, I'd knock him off. Mm-hmm. And he stuck it, and my feet didn't blow. Nori, come here. That's our friend.
Nori, you got something to say? And he stuck, so he stuck the move.
He stuck the move, and then, yeah, and he basically, I have a celebration shot of him pumping his fist right as the sun was just about too dark to climb, you know, to shoot anymore. But it was like, that was like that really special light, really, really special light. And Smith Rock, because of all the aspects of all the climbs, it would get these incredible strips of light, and there's a lot of arêtes, which are like the edges, you know, the corners. Climbing, and Tara Kirshner, actually, who is from that area, she's she has a series that it's like kind of all the things I used to see that I never actually photographed. She just is like nailing it, like with light and shadow, and I always love that contrast. So my favorite photos are just with light and contrast. And yeah, as a photographer, obviously, and filmmaker, and I just love light. And also, you know, I live in the Northwest, and so when you are in a dark house in the Northwest, it's like it feels kind of dreary. But if when I built my place, I made sure that it was south facing. All the rooms felt really good, even when it's really overcast. Like everything feels lit up and feels really good, and that was really, really important to me. Like almost like a deal breaker.
Totally,
you know, deal breaker. Yeah,
totally. Yeah, I have a room that has great morning sunlight, and it's massive, dude. I wake up every morning, like face the sunshine. Butt naked and just know it's going to be a good day. But it's my girlfriend lives in a house where her room is just on the opposite. We're in the same neighborhood, but her room is on the opposite side, you know, of the street, and it's cold all day long because she doesn't get that morning light. It's something that, it's almost like it's one of those things like a car's turning radius that you don't think of when you buy the car, and then you're like, damn it, this is everything.
Yeah. And I made the mistake of living in a place before that, you know, was north facing, and it just always felt cold and not very good. And, you know, it's just it affects your mood so much. Mm. And, I put my bedroom in the southeast corner of the house. So it like gets the, you know, morning light and feels, and then it also just looks down the coast. So it's nice to like just wake up and see the ocean too. And then, you know, it's like the bathroom, you don't need that light. So I put all the bathrooms in the, you know, northeast corner. Mm. And then the edit bay, which, you know, you're always trying to scrub light when you're trying to edit. So I made that kind of the edit zone is in the northeast side of the, but then made the like sunny side too of the, you know, like the hangout zone is sunny. So, and has a view. So it's like everything with designing a home, I was like, I need a place that feels the light, like, motivates me, you know, and then, but then obviously with photography, like light is everything, you know. I love open shade too, reflected light, but, you know, obviously it's better than harsh midday sun, but it also is like,
I interviewed this doctor who works with, she's a light specialist and she researches how light affects human brain and body. And she and her team did a research experiment in an Alzheimer's facility because one of the impacts of Alzheimer's is fractured sleep. You start to sleep worse as Alzheimer's gets worse. And they went into a facility, and all they did was change out all the light bulbs. Because what she says is that not only is, you know, there's a lot of people that talk about how important low light is during the evening and not having that bright blue Walmart light at 10 p.m., that's really important. But what she said is also really important is to have bright light during the day. So you want to be outside, and if you're indoors, you want to have really bright light. You want your computer screen to be fully maxed out during the daytime and then have it ramp down during the night. She did this with the Alzheimer's facility. Their symptoms improved, their sleep improved just by changing the light fixtures in this facility.
Yeah, I can see why that would be, why that is, you know, would happen. I mean, it affects color temperature of your bulbs, and then also the, you know, if it's a really, really cloudy day, like being able to turn all the lights on and just feel like, oh, it's mm-hmm. it's all gonna be fine. And then in the evening, I'm like pretty obsessive about winding down all the lights, you know, having those like really warm color temperatures and like just making sure, and I'm still dialing all that in. You know, I feel like in a house, in a home, like lighting and how you can calm yourself in the evening, but then also acoustics too, like having rooms that feel like warmth comes often from like absorbing some of that high frequency sound or like big echoes and stuff like that. So I've been like sound treating the house kind of like room by room with just different built-ins, and I'm kind of working on some stuff
that's further interesting. Because
it's like tile floor, and so I don't want it to just be all reflective surfaces
bouncing off everywhere. Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, man, that's very important. I wanted to ask you a couple more questions about photography. What do you think is your superpower as a photographer? Someone who was like, you got to nail this, and then put you in an environment with an athlete. Like, what is it where you know you can just knock it out of the park?
I feel like I have the ability to see those moments in between that often get missed because everybody's looking for the peak moments. I mean, obviously, you know, if you're shooting surf and like, you know, you want to nail the, you know, whenever your surfer is like hitting, you know, having their best wave, you don't want to miss that. But same goes for filming. And but there's also just those in between moments that, you know, that's what I built my entire Patagonia career on. You mm-hmm. know, it was like those moments that are just magic that, you know, you wouldn't normally think of as like, oh, this is what you should shoot, you know. And then with portraiture, it's been interesting too, because I feel like I'm deeply intuitive and empathetic and to a fault, but then I feel like that's what, if I can allow myself to be really open to someone and connect with them, then I feel like I'm able to get that connection to capture that portrait in a way that feels like that person's really open.
Mm.
And, you know, it doesn't always work, but it's like, it's, I feel like that deep intuition and attention to detail, just my, within my personality even, allows me to see things that often others don't. And that translates into filmmaking as well. Like that final polish of an edit, finding those little details that just kind of like, well, great at you, but you can't really you can't really tell why it's bugging you, you know? And then that, if you find that flow with that final edit, it really can make a film much more immersive or watchable or whatnot. So I feel like, it can be annoying because I feel like my brain's always working overdrive and noticing things, but then if I can calm it down and like be able to see things clearly without getting overwhelmed, it's like, it's really special. And that's helped me with, you know, all walks of life, with people, with photography and with filmmaking, and yeah. And also just lately I've been helping a lot more with like creative strategy and, you know, I guess people could call it consulting, but like, I feel like I've been in the industry long enough where I can work with brands like Rivian and stuff and like help them. Just, I just notice things when I'm like having a conversation with a bunch of their things, or like the big picture is being presented. It's like, oh, what about this? You know, and finding those details. So I'm learning that I really, really enjoy that.
Right.
And whether that's in any creative pursuit, or, you know, helping a brand or a person with a problem or whatnot. So,
You've been very open about your own health journey and, you know, emotional, psychological journey in your photography and then in your book. Do you feel like being honest and open in that way, which I'm sure has been scary from time to time, has allowed your subjects to open up more with you and get some of these photographs that you can capture of them and tell these kinds of stories in a more personal way?
Yeah, I mean, anytime I feel like having gone through something life-threatening, like I went through colon cancer 20 years ago now. And anytime you've gone through something like that, when you, it kind of just makes you realize that you don't have time for the small talk, you know? And I think that that, and if we can't get beyond that, then it's like kind of pointless to continue the conversation in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, I do think that that's helped me get to know people on a much deeper level. And it was terrifying at first. I mean, I grew up such a shy kid, and kind of remote and rural. And so, you know, I'm a social introvert and I appreciate my alone time, but I also really enjoy connection. And, I think that, you know, we all crave that sort of depth of connection. And I think that's why, you know, during the pandemic and during kind of the Zoom era, like, it's just really tricky to, like, you can't feel people's energy, you know? And I actually prefer, like, if I'm having a deep conversation, I much prefer just being on the phone, because then you feel like you can kind of, like, really vibe in that energy. And when you're on FaceTime, you're just, like, staring at yourself, like, how do I look right now? Do I look awkward? And it's hard to, like, and you're just kind of watching all the cues, but I feel like it's not enough of a cue to really lock in. So
I couldn't agree more, man. I love, if I'm doing a remote interview with someone, I prefer the video to be off, because I think it takes that feeling of self-consciousness away. Whereas if I have a day of meetings where I'm on Zoom calls and my video is on, I feel exhausted afterwards. And it's not in the same way that it would be if it was just a phone call, or even, I mean, in person. I love that because I get energized from being in person. But dude, something about that Zoom video just has like 10% of my brain running on overdrive, being like, these people hate me, these people hate me, these people hate me. Oh God, what do I look like right now? This is unprofessional. This is not a good background. And it takes away from the task at hand, which is to try and communicate clearly.
Yeah, because I think, as humans, we're not, our senses are all kind of on equal playing fields. And when we're on a Zoom call, we're listening, but we're like hyper focused on the visual part you're not really getting the full picture of what's happening. And so you miss a lot of when you synthesize an ingredient, you're missing all the other things that were attached to it. It's like, it's not the real thing, you know? It's like, I think it's just, I mean, it'd be like if we were in a meeting of, like, you know, having a really great in-person meeting and everybody had a little like mirror set up next to them. So they were just like watching themselves as they're trying to talk to everybody else. And it's just not like, who would do that? You know, it's like, who stands in front of the mirror for 8 hours a day? You know, Zoom calls are not natural, you know?
And right. Like,
if it'd be great if there's this way to turn yourself off of that stuff. And I feel like just an easier option to be like, hey, I don't want to see myself, period.
Totally, man. And his E.O. Wilson, old writer, philosopher, said, we have, the problem humanity faces is that we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technologies.
Wow.
It's deep. But it's true, man. I mean, you're afraid of being extricated from your tribe. If you're on a multi-person Zoom call, you're afraid that they're not going to like you and you're going to get sent off to the wolves. You're going to have to go count some crow, swim across the Yellowstone River. Not ready for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think we're all, and we're, it's, if we're at that, you know, I mean, obviously, being on a conference call with just audio is also tricky. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in person is always preferred. But it is one of those things where you're just always like questioning. It's your ability to fit into that group instead of just focusing on what's at hand.
You mm-hmm. know? Yeah. How did you learn how to write?
I wrote a bit in college. I had one of my favorite professors was my literature professor, but he was actually a fishing guy in Montana, and just I really enjoyed that course. But I mean, we're talking like 3-page papers, you know, mm-hmm. And so when the opportunity came to write the book and the Denali short film was, you know, went so crazy online, I knew that there was more to that story, and I knew that I needed to be vulnerable with my story. So it when I wrote the book, it was kind of like, I got to figure this out. And I honestly, when I've even up to the point of getting my book deal with, I wrote the proposal with the help of, Mark Brandt, who used to be Crack Hour's editor, and I met him through John, and, spent like a long time working on that and getting that all dialed up to that point of Penguin, you know, saying, you know, signing the contract or whatever, I still thought that I was going to have a ghostwriter or someone, a co-writer or something. I didn't think that they would, you know, right. But it was in that process of writing the proposal that, you know, my voice kind of came out, and I'd never written anything more than like a short magazine article before, you know? And so, yeah, I learned just by doing, I guess. And, yeah, it's just like photography. I'm self-taught with that too. And I think that, I think that's the best way I can possibly learn in a lot of ways, because, I think creatively, especially like when you go to school for those things and the critiques of that are all, you know, I think that works for some people. But I think if, you know, you're kind of feeling it out and finding your voice, like, you know, like
you the encouragement,
encouragement instead of getting just throttled, you know? And I feel like now with social media being so, with social media being such a, like a, something that just we focus on is like, it's not great. Cause we're like, we automatically compare ourselves constantly mm-hmm. to, we put something out and we're just immediately like looking for the feedback,
yeah,
which is all manufactured anyway, because of all the algorithms and stuff. But then we're just like, we keep scrolling and compare ourselves to everybody else's like polished self. And that really was my biggest motivation for the book, was like, hey, we all go through dark, hard times, and a lot of these things we don't talk about. And as men, oftentimes we don't talk about, you know, we don't get that vulnerable with our health or with our mental health. And I just was like, we gotta break this stigma, you know? And it's been cool, really amazing to see that's finally just happening more mainstream. Like, it's okay to
not be okay.
Yeah, not be okay. And we all go through our, you know, our challenging times, and like, and I'm also just ecstatic to see that, you know, the research that was, you know, speaking of psychedelics, the research that was like abandoned in the 70s is now coming back to you, and with, you know, with MAPS and with, you know, and, you know, psilocybin research and everything. Cause it's, those things are massive. And like, you know, I was on SSRIs for 4 years, and it just like flatlines your, yes, it maybe helped at first, but then you just have this like very like numb existence of like all your like,
when were you on antidepressants?
That was, in my mid-20s.
So before the book.
Yeah, way before the book.
Yeah. Denali came out.
It was like basically got off them as I was getting off chemo. I had so many chemicals in my bloodstream, and I just felt so overloaded with toxins that I couldn't tell where anything was coming from. And so I just quit cold turkey, which is not recommended. And I just stopped. And I think a prescription ran out, and I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. And it was a roller coaster summer, but I was also detoxing from all the heavy metals and everything in the chemo. And I got through it, and then realized that I didn't need that. It was more just maintaining my mental health in other ways, you know, making sure I got exercise and light and friend time and solo time and just doing the things that are needed. And I mean, you know, with seasons, you know, there's seasonal depression and, you know, there's way, you know, I've just realized that there's ways of doing that. And one of those is through microdosing. And I found that to be very, very effective for my own, you know, just getting through those more anxiety times and things like that. I mean, we're talking like not even like 0.1 of psilocybin. It's like we're talking like 50 milligrams or something, like 0.05.
You know the story of Santa Claus and the reindeer?
Oh, yeah.
You know the story, right? So for people who don't know, the Christmas mushroom, Amanita muscaria, the famous red one with the white dots on it, is said to... I mean, it's psychedelic, and it was eaten by reindeer, and it was said that the tribes would eat reindeer meat, and they would trip out, and they would have visions of these flying reindeer.
Or it got dropped down. I think got dropped down their chimneys by the shaman.
Right. Yes, yes. The shaman would also, they would bring it around to the different teepees, right? And they would eat them right around that time.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of...
lore
around that, but the I think it's finding what works for you and what for your body, and this past couple of years I living at the coast, we don't have a great climbing gym out there, and I've been trying to work on figuring out how to like build one there, and with a lot of my friends who have opened them, but I realized that, you know, having that indoor space when it, you know, gets dark early in Oregon, I'm worried about the 45th parallel, so it's not like crazy dark like Alaska or Iceland or something, but it's still, you know, it's a darker time and there's a stormier season, and the coast is beautiful because the storms move through quickly and then we'll often have sunshine amidst all the storms. And but this about a year and a half ago I started practicing jiu-jitsu as well, which has been massive for me. And Lee Leatherman, who's dad found in Leatherman, he opened a little satellite campus or satellite school of like Gracie Techniques, which started in Honolulu in Portland, through the Pedro Sauer lineage. And at that, you know, starting a martial art in my mid to late 40s, like, was not something I ever expected. And I never done any martial arts, but it just, that's been incredible, like physically and emotionally and mentally.
Something
just
new too.
Yeah. But also just to get put in extreme discomfort and to relax in that. I think it's good for our fight or flight systems to be put in situations that are extremely uncomfortable, but then realize that you can start over, you know,
right,
just tap and start over. And so having that something to do in the winter that is just, you can be held accountable by others but also really look forward to, is huge, you know.
I think that depression and seasonal depression is, I think of it almost like I've broken my wrist a bunch of times skateboarding, and I'm typing all day, and sometimes I can start to feel it flare up. And it doesn't happen all at once, but I can kind of feel it start to come in, and I know, okay, you better stop and like go move your wrist around a little bit, go put an ice pack on it, put a heat pack on it, because if you keep going, it's going to get way worse, and then you're going to have to take like 2 days off. And I feel the same way about depression. Like, it doesn't happen all at once. You start to just feel this little weird thing. And if you can catch it right then and be like, I need to go do jiu-jitsu right now. I need to go exercise. I need to go be around people. And if you have a bit of a methodology around it, as it sounds like you've developed, it can really save you a lot of grief, man, rather than waiting until you're in the pits of December and you just feel like everyone hates you. It's massive, man.
Yeah. Or just, you know, having a dog's amazing, 'cause they're like, hey, I gotta go outside and go for a walk, and I need to scrub some energy off. Yeah. And so and oftentimes it's funny, like, I mean, there's probably a metaphor in there too, but like, if it's, you know, in the middle of a storm cycle, low pressure on the coast there, if you just put on, you know, rain jacket and rain boots or whatever, and go out, it's usually not that bad. It's usually south, it's a southwester, so it's pretty warm out. the rain's not as hard as it seems like it sounds from it's hitting the windows, you know, mm-hmm. it's just not bad. And you just go out there and then your mood completely shifts by just going for a half hour walk. And then your dog's happier and more chill. But it's finding those early indicators and recognizing when it's coming on and also just being like, have your friends that you can reach out to and just chat, you know, and just be, and not feel like you're super isolated. And I feel like I've been thinking about this a lot because this last couple months, I just went through a breakup, and like my three or four biggest breakups in my life all happened right after Thanksgiving. And it feels like I've been thinking about a lot of time about like wintering and shedding and how being okay with the darkness and the quiet and being okay with being alone and sitting in that and not just running. And, you know, I wanted to just go on a road trip immediately, but I got that head and chest thing that was going around, and I still have like a little residual stuffiness from it. And it took a couple of weeks to get rid of it. And I was kind of stuck, and I was like, okay, I can't travel right now. I don't want anybody to get sick. So I need to just sit in this and feel it. And it's not fun. But I'm just going to be there. I couldn't go to jiu-jitsu or do anything else. It was like a really, one of those times where it's like, I just need to be okay. Mm. And then not like try to run from it or medicate or, you know, try to get away. Just be like, hey, like, what do I need right now? And to just like allow the grieving process to flow through you to like, just to do that like deep thinking of like, well, how can I change as a person? How can I learn from this? And how can I like grow instead of being like, my life sucks. And like, you know, like, I hate everybody because they're all like, you know, out to get me. It's like, no, it's like, hey, like, I know I had a part in this, and how can I grow from it? But then also, how can I like go into something later or in a relationship, whether it's work or friendship or whatnot, to be, you know, a better communicator and a better person. And so I've just thought a lot about that, how just like sitting in the quiet can teach us so much. And a lot of, oftentimes I feel like we're just running from that. So
some of the best creative achievements in the history of our species have come from real sad people going through that and giving way to a masterpiece. It really does. It connects you in to something that can be really hard to access when you're happy go lucky.
And I think, you know, same goes for art, you know, mm-hmm. amazing poetry and filmmaking comes from, you know, the darker times. And my friend John Craigie, you might know from Santa Cruz, the musician, he had one song that was something about like, what was it? Like the only good music comes out of times when we're in like really the bad political, when like the things aren't going like really bad, like,
totally.
Like good, all the good music comes out of the eras that are the gnarliest, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And
yeah.
It's just like he like listed off all the bands that were during like the good economy and the like, you know, good social, everything was happening in the right, you know, like nothing was bad happening. And he's like, oh, the music was like extremely shallow and poppy.
Most great music came from the people who have been most oppressed historically.
Exactly. Like all the blues and yeah. all that stuff, just incredible. But like that came from extreme darkness.
Yeah. How much at this point, curious about this, going through a breakup, how much at this point in your life do you feel like, okay, I'm still here to change and I want to change versus this is me and I just need to find more people who are down with who I am and what my habits are? Like, how much have you just kind of accepted that you are the way you are versus actively trying to change who you are?
I mean, you know, I'm in my later 40s now, and you know, there's a level of acceptance that comes there of who I am and the things I do enjoy. But the people that I look up to the most that are my mentors, my photography heroes, and the people that are, you know, they're all the most curious people I've ever met. mm-hmm. and they care less about, they ask more questions, and as someone who like notices so much, like I've learned, I've had to ask, teach myself to ask more questions. And I feel like, yeah, I already am this onloading so much information that I have to physically think about, like, I need to continue to ask questions. But also that curiosity, just, it makes someone such a, even in my creative careers, I've seen, you know, all the eras, like going from film to digital to, you know, filmmaking to social media to all these different like chapters of, you know, and I've seen people that have like completely become inflexible and stagnant, mm-hmm. and refuse to change, and their career kind of like dies right there.
Mm.
You know, and I don't want to be that, and I just want to continue to evolve, both as a human, you know, as a partner, as a friend, as, you know, as a creative. I just want to continue to evolve, and like, I don't know what's next, you know? And it's, whenever you're in lulls, it's scary and it's weird, and you're like, what's next? Like, or you're single or whatnot. It just feels, there is a feeling like, will anybody ever like be able to, you know, really appreciate the weirdo that I am, mm. you know? And like, in this, just because like, I know that I have my quirks, and I know that there are, you know, ways I was, you know, there are things that are in our like genetic makeup that make us who we are. And there's things that I know I love. I know I love being by the ocean. I know I love, living not in a city center. You know, I know I need the fresh air and the space and, the horizon to stare off into, you know, but I also just, I know I need deep connection. And, so it's like, yeah, just the casual shallowness of a lot of human relating aren't that interesting to me.
Mm.
So I just, you know, obviously there's small talk that we have to get through, but I just prefer the,
yeah. So what's an aspect of yourself that you are actively looking at with a more curious lens? Maybe you're trying to actively change it, and maybe you're just kind of diving, because I do think that breakups can be super helpful mirrors for us, whether or not we decide to change those aspects of ourselves. I think that it can be a time when you get to kind of see a microscope on who you are, in a way that isn't always accessible.
Yeah. And I've been working with, for the last like 12 or 15 years, I've been working with amazing mentor, life coach, therapists that like are really more on the intuitive spectrum, and really can, you know, I found with like traditional talk therapy, a lot of times I can, because I'm so intuitive, I can kind of like evade all the hard stuff. But with someone who is as intuitive, and like
they pin you down,
they just corner you. And I've been working with one woman that like, and I've learned so much even through this last few months, and just kind of like highlighted some stuff. And I think that, you know, as when I was younger, I feel like there was, you know, there was a lot of struggle, and I feel like just the way I was raised, there wasn't a lot of like showing of a lot of joy. You know, it was like, I feel like everything was sort of like dampened. It was like, you never showed too much happiness. And so it was like really interesting to learn that I was like, oh, I've kind of been from experience, like I don't exhibit joy, even though I feel it, like I feel a peace inside. I don't exhibit joyfulness to the full extent of what I could. And I'm like, whoa, that was like a kind of a, like a really like, oh, I've never, how did I go this far without recognizing that, you know? And I think it was because there was always like, I was waiting for the other shoe to drop. I was like, well, something's wrong is going to happen, you know? So I was always afraid to like get too excited about something, because then what if it just got ripped away? Then if I dull my expectations, then, and that carries to every part of your life. If you like don't expect, you know, if you don't set your goals high, then you're never going to achieve anything more than that. And I've always had, fortunately, like, I think there, you know, I don't know how I got to where I am in my career and all the opportunities I've had, but it was always just this little bit of I always have had that curiosity to kind of like, what's behind that door, you know? And that has introduced me to some people that I never expected to meet, you know? And I think, I just don't want to lose that curiosity, but I, you know, it's just like learning that, yeah, like you, there is another spectrum of joy to experience. And like that's a really cool thing to learn.
Yeah. It's super cultural, man. I mean, I have like a lot of my friends who are like from Montana, for example, they're just more, toned down in their emotions because of the culture. Like it's not a, you know, Southern California beach culture where you're, you know, flying your freak flag every day. It's like a real, it's just a different, it's almost like a different, decibel, you know, of like an accepted decibel depending on culture. So what might feel like you being really happy and excited might seem bummed out to someone else who grew up in a different culture.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, I mean, I grew up in, you know, the upper Midwest, the Great Lakes, but it's, you know, there's a lot of like my dad, you know, came from a family of Polish immigrants, and it was that, you know, auto workers, and that, you know, it's like not, it wasn't like, yeah, everything's going hunky-dory. It's like neither of my parents had money growing up. So it was like there, it's like, and so it was like, there's a level of like Midwest sort of like, you know, it's gotta be hard.
Yeah.
It's like, and you know, that is, I remember I think it was Andrew Bird interview, like Tiff Merritt was interviewing him, and he nailed it with that. It was like something about just, he grew up somewhere in the Midwest as well, and it was just something about how just that the guilt if you have too much happiness or whatever. And so
it's doing all right. We're okay. Can't complain. Yeah. Can't complain. Oh,
it's not so bad.
It's not so bad. Yeah.
And yeah, I think that it has been moving out west, and you know, Oregon, there's a little bit of that in some of the rural areas too, the coast. I feel like there's some of the older fishermen that definitely have that too, you know, like, but I also think that a lot of that came from men having to temper their emotions and not showing that they were having a hard time, or, you know, and so it was always just like,
yeah, you don't show it.
You just like numb everything. So otherwise others would perceive that as weakness. And so it's just, it's like learning how to be open and vulnerable, I think is part of that journey. So,
yeah.
But I do think, yeah, like it's always sunny in Southern California, you know.
It's like, and it's funny just how you know, we've talked about like the native tribes, the late 1800s, and just how, what a short time it's been between small banded tribes living out really in deep nature to Instagram culture. Like, and between that, it was, you know, illiterate farmers to the baby boomers to now. Like, when I think about the 1960s, like just how culturally jarring that must have been to the 1950s culture. Nothing like that had ever really happened, to have that level of just human exuberance and openness shown on like a wide level. It's what our parents were culturally accustomed to is very different than the culture now. So it makes sense that we wouldn't all be aligned on just how much emotion is okay to show.
Definitely. And you know, it's in the 60s and 70s, I mean, obviously that was the era of like a lot of, you know, as my dad would say, like too many psychedelics, you know, but it's like there's a, you know, people were not as calculated as we are now. But I feel like that what those, you know, what psychedelics can do for you is open your mind to that full spectrum, because we suddenly lose our sense of like self-consciousness and like being worrying that we're different than everybody else. Suddenly we realize we're all in this together. And what I've, you know, in all my experiences with plant medicine and with those, you know, deeper journeys, I've always felt immense love for those that I've always, you know, like for old breakups or old, you know, relationships that are just, you always realize that, hey, we were all doing, you know, we are all like trying,
all doing our best.
We're all trying, and
yeah.
We're all doing our best. It's a standard, that's a standard Midwest phrase, but it truly is like, we are, you have an appreciation for what others have done for you instead of all the like wounds, you know, you're able to like drop the trauma and mm-hmm. like see things and connect on a deeper level. And I think we all need more of that. And I think after, you know, if you think about the '60s, after all coming out of the war era and everything else, it's like realizing that we could just think about things in a just a more broad sense and like get rid of those like guard, you know, those just deep ruts that we're mm-hmm. living in and raised in.
Yeah. I think that to not put blame on a person who you're close to where the relationship didn't work out shows an immense amount of maturity. My parents divorced when I was 6, and they just made an agreement that they were never going to talk shit about each other in front of me. My only experience of divorce until I was in my teens was that I got another house. I had no idea that there was like an association that divorce had to do anything with a relationship not working out, because they were just kind about it and they were super cool. And I think that's just for most people are going to go through breakups in their lives, and depending, like deciding how you want to talk about it and think about it is a really massive, it's just massive, you know, and it, you know, as you're talking about it, like, you know, yeah, there was probably some things that I'm taking responsibility for my part in it. And there's also a lot of beauty in what you share with a person, even if you're not together for your entire lives, to not cast this narrative of it just being a shit relationship is the right way to go about it. And it's something that I think a lot of people don't really think about what narrative they want to craft around a relationship when the relationship is no more.
Yeah. And I think there's, you know, conscious on decoupling rather than like running something into the ground or like, you know, someone finding a exit strategy, whether it's, you know, cheating or infidelity or whatever, like there's a way to be like, hey, listen, like we're on different trajectories here. Mm-hmm. Like, let's just say it, call it for what it is. And I, you know, like have a deep appreciation for what we shared and call it before it becomes like this just dumpster fire, you know, and it doesn't have to be that hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be, there's sadness there, but it also can be like, hey, listen, I want you to thrive and I hope you want me to thrive too. So it's like this finding that way of like, and then there's way less of that, like, you know, venting that comes out later, you know, like, yeah, like there's still like a grieving process, but there's less of that, like
just a laundry list of complaints.
Just complaints. Cause it's like inevitably like there's two sides of everything and there's misunderstandings and, you know, communication is like one of the most, you know, challenging things for two human beings to do, you know, it's like in
most wars created because of bad communication.
Yeah, and misunderstandings and preconceived notions and
So what's a piece of advice you would have given your younger self about breakups?
Just realize it's not all about you, you know? It's like there's two people involved and like And just go easy on yourself. I think it's easy to, you know, when you're going through it, feel like, you know, no one will ever love you again, or they'll have all those like standard human emotions of rejection and all that. But then realize that like, hey, like if you can learn from this and grow from it, then, I mean, I would have never, you know, I was married super young if that hadn't gone, you know, failed, I probably would have never picked up a camera and had the career I have now, you know, and wouldn't hit the road and done that. And oftentimes what seem like the darkest hours are the greatest opportunities. And so just recognizing that, to not like wallow and let yourself just like go into a tailspin, but just like seeing like, hey, there's an opportunity here. And oftentimes that opportunity is to take a little time for yourself and reevaluate who you are without the lens of another person and, you know, mirroring whatever you're going through, but being like, hey, like, what do I actually need right now? What do I want in a relationship in the future? What can I offer you know, or do I just need to be alone for a while? Like, it's just figuring out what that, it's a great time to reevaluate. And just like I was talking about, like the wintering and the shedding, it's like, okay, here's a good time to like do the deep clean. And so,
there's a show on Netflix called Loser. Have you heard about this?
I have not.
It's so great. It's about, athletes that have lost huge events. So like the guy who blew the biggest kick of his life and follows up on what he's doing 20 years from now. And there are all these incredible stories about people having these wild lives and being successful in their own way because of the loss. And it's such a powerful concept to communicate to a society that is obsessed with winners. Because if you have these minor triumphs in life, but if you just get hung up on that, or you just get hung up on your losses, like, you're just putting a period at the end of it when it should be like a comma and we have no idea what's going to happen next now. And I just felt like it was a very important story to communicate to a society that is obsessed with this binary conversation between winners and losers, and winning and losing, and success and failure.
Good. I always feel like that. Yeah, it's easy to be like, hey, I don't, the last couple of years I didn't do anything, or, you know, it's like you look back on a year and you're kind of like, and one beautiful thing about having computer and a camera in your pockets all the time is like, we have a diary of the last year, because you take photos of just about everything you go through. And so it's like, for me, it's good to be like, oh, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. Even if you just go through your favorites or whatever, it's like, wow, I did grow a lot. I met some great people. I had some great experiences. And with a relationship or a breakup, it's always these mile markers. And we're like, oh, like, or I lost a client, or, you know, it's like, well, usually in those experiences, that's when something really, you know, through that space, like, it's just like saying no to something that isn't great for you. Like, when you allow, when you take one thing away, you allow something new to come in. And so it's always like it's an opportunity. And also, like, the comma and you're just saying, it's like, we often think we're right back to where we were when we had our last, like, whatever breakup or, you know, last peak experience. No, it's like, we've grown so much since then. And if you haven't, then that's when it's time to reevaluate, you know? And so I think that having that more like ever evolving, ever growing, always trying to change, and like, and not just being like, I am who I am, I'm not going to change. And that frustrates me. You know, it's like, if someone gets that stiff and doesn't want to change, it's like, well, you're not going to have, you won't expand who you can be.
Yeah, you'll actually just get smaller. You will be changing. You'll just continue to
because you start fearing everything, and that's what, you know, it's so easy if we just like read the news headlines every day to feel like everything in the world's going, you know, completely wrong.
Yeah.
And instead, if we can, you know, we can, there is change we can do by, you know, screaming into the void. You know, there, some things do happen through social media and through, you know, rallying a cause. But I feel like the greatest change is when we have these one-on-one conversations and like our direct community, you know, and like, cause those, all the ripple effects of that are just, you just never know, you know, you have no idea. Like, I remember giving an, book reading for the Oregon Literary Awards or something. And this, I was saying like, oh, it's been amazing to read, you know, some people, things that people have shared about what they felt, what, how the book, they related to my book. And this older author like got in there, he's like, listen, dude, listen, Sonny. He's like, you will never understand the full impact of what your words will have to other people. The ripple effect of that is just going to carry, and you'll never understand the full effect of that. And so and I feel like that's, you know, our everyday conversations too. We just don't know what a kind word or a little, you know, little thing you say can change someone's life, that changes their whole thing and sparks a whole something new. And so I feel like it's just, it's so easy to, you know, get that fear mentality and like feel, and like you said, the world keeps shrinking because everything's scary out there. But if you just, you know, can like look at the bigger picture and be like, hey, what can I affect change in mm-hmm. my direct life? And then in myself, then that just always is more, way more expansive, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And just what needs to be done in the room that I'm entering into right now. Actually, my ex-girlfriend told me this one. She's something I've taken with me. She's like, I'll walk into a room and think, how do I want to make these people feel?
Wow.
It's a great question to ask yourself.
Yeah.
It's like, then it just takes all of it off of you and onto how do I want to make these people feel? And then the next answer is pretty clear.
And it doesn't always need to be taking up space in a conversation either. It's like oftentimes, like what I've learned in the last, you know, few years is like I need to relearn a lot of things that I had preconceived notions about. And you know, with, you know, all the oppression and colonialism and, you know, patriarchy and everything that's happened, it's like just sitting back and listening and learning and then trying to like understand what that might mean for me and how I can help. But it's instead of, you know, I feel like oftentimes it's like we all want to like interject something immediately when really what we need to do is just like sit and listen and think and allow other voices to be elevated and not, you know, drown them out. So
what is your writing practice look like now? Do you have writing habits?
I'm trying to get back into, I never was a journaler, and I'm realizing that I need to start, what works best for me is just writing a little bit every day. When I was writing the book, it was usually in the evening. I would kind of have a, you know, brain dump, and then in the morning I would kind of edit it.
Just Hunter Thompson style, just a bottle of tequila, lines of cocaine, shivers, more shivers, quaaludes, Denali. No,
it's more just like, you know, you think about it all day, and then you just, if you can just write one sentence, or just sometimes that sentence becomes like a few pages, and then in the morning, but not be too precious with it, and then in the morning edit that. But oftentimes, like that half, you know, 2/3 of that book was written with voice memos and dictated things when I'd just be driving and think of something, and I just get the thought down, and then I would go back and rewrite and flesh it out and try to like figure out what the bigger picture was. And I've been working on a new book that, and just the ideas have been flowing really well, but it's like, there's a lot, it's a lot of that. It's little vignettes. And so now I feel like in order to finish the proposal, I need to sit down and really flesh out those, you know, kind of link all those things together so they can, you know, be like an outline and a sample chapter and all that stuff. So
sweet. And so you'll just do voice memos, and then will it go voice to text then?
Yeah. Often I'll just hit the, you know, the dictate button and just
while you're driving or something
and just like just ramble,
start talking
and make sure it's actually recording it.
Mm-hmm.
Cause if I do just do a voice memo, it's then I have to type it and everything. So it's better just at least get the gist of it. And obviously voice dictation has gotten so good now that it usually gets most of the, most of it. And I remember, I can't remember what interview it was, like some music interview. It was like somebody's talking about Tom Waits and how he was just like, we'd be driving down the LA freeway pre iPhone or recorders and just be like a song would come to me and be like, why now?
Oh,
you know, it's like, it's like, and now we have an ability to actually record that, you know,
slippery fish. Those ideas are slippery fish. You got to get them down.
And then in the middle of the night too, or like early in the morning when you wake up to take a leak or whatever, it's like there'll be a thought.
Yeah.
And it will never be there in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
It never. And I found I just have to like, you know, quickly like grab my phone, jot down a quick note. And notes are where most of it goes, you know, and then in the morning you read that, you're like, whoa, that was something. And then you can continue to like build on that. So
That's super cool. That's super cool. Do you have any New Year's resolutions?
I feel like I kind of try to set aside the resolution thing and more just set intentions of, you know, the connections and things I want to happen that, you know, this year, and more like allow for that, allow for the growth. I feel like I've had a lot of irons in the fire that have been kind of simmering for a while. And I've just, I just am looking forward to those kind of,
anything in particular that you're excited about would be a great year for you?
I mean, I think a lot of us feel like, I feel like for myself at least, that, that we're coming out of, I came out of like writing the book, and which is an amazing opportunity, but I was living in my van when I was doing that. So I like, and I was building the house at the same time I was living in my van. And so like my, and then finally got moved into that, you know, and started a beautiful relationship, and that ended. And so now I feel like I'm in this whole new, like, and the pandemic was in the middle of all that. So it just was like a really like intense period where I kind of was like limiting on what I would do for either financial or time reasons. And then now I feel like I'm just like, wow, like I really have the opportunity to like see what happens and let her rip. And there was an option for the Denali book that expired, and now there's some new opportunities with a couple other production companies. I'm pretty sure I know which direction I'm going with that, and I'm really excited for that because my she wasn't my attorney, now she's kind of an advisor who I worked with a lot. She helped crack out with Into the Wild and all that stuff, and she's just been in this industry forever, and she's just like, listen, most people when they write a book, the option expires, that's your only chance. And so she goes, to have this second opportunity to tell your story in the right way is really beautiful, and I'm really excited about that. And I can't name any names right now because nothing's official, but I'm hopefully I can do that soon, because it's really I'm really excited for, and just to work on with a new writer and some other people, and just to help tell that in the right way. So
hell yeah. That's so exciting.
Yeah. Cause I've always felt like that needed to be like a very connected, like indie film. And there was like kind of, it's always tricky, you know, Hollywood's tricky to navigate, but I feel like I found the right people that are super empathetic and understand and see me. I feel like it always feels good to be seen, you know?
Sure does. It's good to see you, man.
Likewise, Kyle. Yeah.
At Ben Moon. At Ben Moon on Instagram.
At Ben _ Moon.
Reach out.
Yeah.
Send love. Send hate. Send ideas.
Preferably love. But yeah, I'm just excited for what's to come, and yeah, stoked for you and to hear what's coming next too. So
thank you. Yes. So much. And it's great to see you since you had that gallon of piss in your hand at Burning Man all those years ago. We've come so far since that fateful day.
We have. Yeah. Thanks for having me. And, yeah, I look forward to continuing the conversation in the future.
Anytime, man. Absolute blast. So much respect for you and the work that you're putting out into the world, man. Takes a lot, and, keep doing it.
Thank you. You too.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you. Lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.